Welcome to a special edition of The Point. I'm John Basile. There is a musical connection between New Orleans and Cape Cod. Sometimes I think of it as a thin blue line that depicts a secondary road on an old map. It runs from that multicultural old world southern city to sandy Cape Cod. There is also a spiritual connection between two men who could not have been more different. One, a son of New Orleans who rose from extreme poverty to become one of the most recognizable and famous people in the world. The other, a son of Cape Cod, whose open mind and love of music led him to become one of the great chroniclers of American jazz. I'm talking, of course, about the late Louis Armstrong, the first jazz star, the man who virtually created the music starting in the early part of the 20th century. And I'm talking about Jack Bradley, born in Cotuit, attended Mass Maritime Academy, and later met and befriended Armstrong, eventually amassing a trove of Armstrong memorabilia that today makes up a good part of the collection of the Armstrong House Museum in New York. Bradley lived in Harwich and passed away in 2021. With me today to help tell this extraordinary story are Michael Persico, a musician and friend of the late Jack Bradley, who has organized much of Jack's photographs and now tours with a band celebrating both Bradley and Armstrong. Welcome, Mike.
Thank you.
And we're also joined on the phone by Ricky Riccardi, the director of research collections at the Louis Armstrong House Museum in Queens, New York. Hello, Ricky.
Hello, happy to be here.
We should also say you're also the author of a couple of books on Armstrong and a Grammy winner in your own right. I'd like to start with you, Ricky. Can you place Louis Armstrong in American cultural and musical history?
To me, he's the defining figure of the 20th century because from a musical standpoint, there's what he did with the trumpet. There's what he did with his voice. I mean, you can name a million great instrumentalists, a million great vocalists. Armstrong completely changed the way people played music on their instruments, and he completely changed the way people sang. So if it was just the music, he would be a towering influence, not just on jazz, but American popular music, modern jazz, hip-hop, soul, rock and roll. It all kind of stems from Louis Armstrong. But then there's his story, this rags-to-riches story, growing up poor in New Orleans and going on to be America's ambassador of goodwill, multimedia superstar, conquers film, radio, television, the stage, the recording studio. And then he's a civil rights pioneer, not afraid to put his career on the line to speak out against racial injustice. And when you add it all up, yes, everybody knows What a Wonderful World and it's a beautiful song, but really, he is the 20th century.
Mike, if you would, could you put in capsule form Jack Bradley's life and career?
Well, Jack was a sailor by heart, actually, just being born in Cotuit and raised on Cape Cod. He loved the sea. But he also had a love of jazz. He went to New York to meet his idol, his hero, Louis Armstrong, backstage one night, and the rest is history.
But the story begins a little earlier than that.
Jack first saw Louis perform in Hyannis at the Old Elks Club. This was 1955, and we have some of the first snapshots of Louis Armstrong, which are now at the Armstrong House Museum, thanks to Ricky and all the wonderful work archiving the Jack's art.
Now, you knew Jack very well later in his life. Did he ever explain to you what was the spark, what he saw in Louis Armstrong that made him become such a fan?
I'd probably have to say the same thing that Catherine Russell said to me about Louis Armstrong. Louis was all about love. That came out in the way he spoke, the way he dressed, the way he played, the way he sang. So if you were to shrink it down to the one thing, I would just have to say it was Louis' love of life.
Ricky, do you have any stories about their earliest get-togethers?
Well, like Mike said, you know, early on, Jack was just a fan. You know, he would show up to the gig with his Brownie Hawkeye camera and snap a few photos. But I don't think he ever dreamed that he would get as close. The reason he did get us close, we should give a quick shout-out to a woman named Jean Fallows, who used to help Armstrong answer fan mail, and she was kind of a trusted member of Armstrong's backstage entourage. And Jean met Jack at a recording session. They began dating in about 1958-59, and then Jean invited Jack backstage at an Armstrong concert, The big moment was when Jean invited Jack to accompany her to Lewis's home in Corona, Queens. There's obviously a lively get-together, a bunch of people, music on, everybody's talking, everybody's drinking. Then everybody goes downstairs, and the only two people left in Lewis's den were Lewis and Jack Bradley, and Jack froze. But Lewis sensed it, and Lewis went over to him, put his arm around him, and said, "It's cool, man, we're just talking." Totally put him at ease, and they became close friends for the rest of Lewis's life. I mean, Lewis used to call him his white son.
Lewis was a writer, a keeper of notes and tape recordings and everything you can imagine. How did some of that come into Jack's possession?
Well, it's a funny thing. You know, Lewis was his own archivist. He would save photographs. He would save reel-to-reel tapes. He would make scrapbooks. So he already was doing that going back to the 1920s. Jack, I think, sensed that there was something important about Louis Armstrong, and he also got the feeling that people were taking him for granted, especially in the 1960s. Jack would always get excited when Louis would come to New York, when he would perform in places like Freedomland, and then he would look around, and there wouldn't be any real musicians there. Or, you know, I've seen them, Hello Dolly, you know, he's kind of past his prime. And so Jack, at a certain point, realized that this guy represents history. People are sleeping on him. One day, they're going to realize this was important. And so Jack was never obnoxious about it. He always asked politely and always waited for Lewis to make the first move. But all of a sudden, Jack is taking some of Lewis's fan mail home with him. And then Jack is taking his hotel receipts and his laundry bills and a couple of handkerchiefs. And Lewis was happy to give it to him. And probably the most famous story is Lewis going through photographs in his den, giving Jack photos. And he goes, "You want to take this one? You want to take that one? You want to take this one?" And Jack goes, "Sure, I'll take it. I'll take it. I'll take it." And he takes a couple of dozen of Lewis Armstrong's personal photos. And then Lewis goes, "Let me sign one to you." And he signed one to Jack Bradley, the greatest photo taker. And when Jack first looked at that, he thought that maybe Lewis was trying to spell photographer or, you know, well, you know, what did he mean by that? And then all of a sudden it clicked. It said, "Wait a minute, I'm always taking his photos." It's a little tongue-in-cheek joke there, but it's the two perfect collections. I mean, where I work at the Lewis Armstrong House Museum, we have one cornerstone is Lewis Armstrong stuff, and the other cornerstone is the Jack Bradley collection. Yeah. And between the two, you really get a complete portrait of the man.
When I was writing my own book about jazz on Cape Cod, Jack told me he walked into Lewis's den at his home one day, and he's sitting there looking at papers and throwing them in the trash cans. "Oh, I don't need this. I don't need this." And Jack says to him, "What are you doing there?" He said, "I don't need these papers. I'm throwing them out." And Jack picks them up and looks at them. And one is like a letter from some famous person. Another one is an honorary degree or a photograph or something. He says, "Maybe I should take some of those things." Is that a true story?
It must be, because I mean, the collection has stuff that Lewis would have viewed as garbage.
Now, Michael, in your dealings with Jack, did you get any insight? Did you get to see some of the really good stuff in the collection?
Well, when I started working for Jack in 2013. When I went over his house, the Armstrong house had already cleaned out all of his Lewis stuff with, I think, 8 van loads and brought it back to New York. When I got there, I was amazed. It looked like that TV show Hoarders. Only without the newspapers in the hallway. I mean, he collected everything. Yeah. And I mean, it took me 6 years just to get through the magazines, the records, the CDs that he had. When I found his negatives, they were all in envelopes in the closet and shoe boxes all around. There was over 30,000 pictures that he had taken. He was kind of a pack rat that way. So, but again, it was like Hoarders with a purpose.
And that takes us to your Classic Jazz Visions book, which features Jack's photographs. Is the book available? And I hear there's something new happening with it.
The book is available on our website, classicjazzvisions.org. It's all about 94, 95 pages of all black and white photos of not only Louis Armstrong, but Duke Ellington, Ella Fitzgerald, local luminaries like Ruby Braff, Lou Colombo, Dave McKenna, Bobby Hackett. The list is endless, and there are a lot of people in there that have faded into obscurity that were big names in the 20s and 30s, but by the time Jack had met them, they were well into the twilight of their careers, like Red Allen and a few people like that, and Jack was there. He was everybody's pal, and he raised funds to help bury Red Allen when he passed away and help out his widow. So that's the kind of guy Jack was, so I figured this best way to honor Jack was to put together a a coffee table book, as well as a concert series where we have a slideshow of a lot of Jack's work with my band, the Classic Jazz and Swing Orchestra.
Now, just as we were talking, I opened that book to a random page, and on the left-hand side is a nice picture. Zoot Sims on saxophone, Ruby Braff on cornet. Facing that is a picture I've never seen before of Duke Ellington. This is one-of-a-kind stuff taken by someone who was there. I once said to Jack Bradley, boy, the time the Duke Ellington band and the Count Basie band recorded together, that must have been some great scene. Wow. And he said, oh, yeah, I was there.
Well, most of these pictures have never been published before. They've existed in negative form for all these years, especially the ones of Duke Ellington on the Cape. And with our second printing, we'll be adding some color photos as well that Jack took.
This is The Point on CAI. We're talking about the connection between the great Louis Armstrong and Cape Cod. We'll have more after this break. First, though, here's more of West End Blues, one of Armstrong's early hits, recorded in 1928. Listening to The Point on CAI, we're talking about the connection between the late great entertainer Louis Armstrong and Cape Cod. Our guests are Cape Cod musician Mike Persico and Ricky Riccardi with the Louis Armstrong House Museum in New York. Ricky, if you would you fill us in on everything that goes on at the Louis Armstrong House Museum?
Sure. I mean, kind of a miracle that it even exists, because the crown jewel is the Louis Armstrong House, the house where Louis and his wife Lucille lived from 1943 until Louis's passing in 1971. It's the house that Jack Bradley was at countless times, and Dizzy Gillespie, Clark Terry, Bobby Hackett, you name it, they all spent time there. And no one has lived there since the Armstrongs. Lucille Armstrong had it declared a National Historic Landmark, and it opened to the public in 2003. And so for over 20 years, people have come from around the world, and they get a docent-led experience walking through the house, all the original furnishings, the original paintings. You hear Louis's voice, you hear excerpts from his tapes in every room. It's really quite a unique experience and a very emotional experience. Across the street, last summer, we opened the Louis Armstrong Center. It has a 75-seat performance room. They have a state-of-the-art exhibit, and we have a gift shop. But for me, most excitingly, upstairs, it's now the new home of the Louis Armstrong Archives. The archives were always at Queens College, and it was the world's largest archives for any single jazz musician. Thanks to the acquisition of the Jack Bradley collection, the entire archive, you know, right on the same street where Louis and Jack used to hang, which was pretty amazing. And I should say, for me personally, I kind of owe my livelihood to Jack Bradley, because I had been doing research at the Armstrong Archives, and I'd been writing a book on Louis Armstrong, and I'd interviewed Jack Bradley. This is all about 2006, 2007. And then the Louis Armstrong House got a grant to hire an archivist specifically to process the Jack Bradley collection. Very shrewdly, my number one reference on my application was Jack Bradley. My second day on the job, October 2009, we got a van and we went up to the Cape and we unloaded more Jack stuff. We went the following year and got even more. And the latest thing I've been working on, during the pandemic, we started a website called That's My Home. It's all virtual exhibits. Louis would go on tours of Australia and Japan and places, and Jack wasn't there for those tours. But anytime Jack and Louis were together and Jack had a camera or Jack was taking notes, I'm trying to tell that story as completely as possible, using the photos, using the negatives, using fan mail and other things from the collection. And I feel like it's a great way, I think, of keeping Jack alive, keeping Louis alive, keeping that story alive. I think between what I'm doing at the Armstrong House, what Mike's doing on the Cape and around the whole New England area, I think the legacy of Jack and Louis is going stronger than ever right now.
At the beginning of the program, we heard West End Blues from 1928, which I consider one of the real starting points for Louis Armstrong's music. Ricky, if we jump ahead just a few years to stardust. How has his music changed and grown?
Well, yeah, Stardust was recorded in November 1931, and so it's only 3 years after West End Blues, but now it's a big band. Now it's a Hoagy Carmichael pop tune, Tin Pan Alley. We got beautiful lyrics by Mitchell Parrish. And so you think, oh, it's going to be the commercial Louis Armstrong, but then you hear it. He sings it with his own melody, changes the lyrics, he improvises, he phrases it beautifully, and all of a sudden it is now Louis Armstrong's interpretation of Stardust, and it stands out. It sounds like it comes from another planet, but once you hear it, it's unforgettable.
Sometimes I wonder why I spend such lonely nights. Oh, baby, lonely nights. Dreaming of a song, melody, memory, and I'm once again with you. When our love was new, oh, each kiss an inspiration. Now that, baby, you know, long ago. Oh, beside a garden wall, when stars are bright, and you are in my arms, baby. The nightingale tells its fairy tale of paradise where roses bloom. Though I dream in vain, oh, in my heart it will remain, baby. My stardust melody, oh memory, oh memory, oh memory.
The Louis Armstrong House Museum received a grant from the Louis Armstrong Educational Foundation back in 2005 to acquire the Jack Bradley collection. And so I think the original plan was we would just take it all in one shot, but Jack was too emotional and could not bear to part with it all. And so the plan was we would make one trip a year, and after 5 or 6 years, we would have everything. And that's when I started getting calls from Mike Persico. It's like, hey, I found some negatives. You know, hey, we found some tapes, you know, this and that. And then the last time I saw Jack in 2017, I'm leaving the basement, and I look over to the right, and there was a stack of 3-inch reel-to-reel tapes, and they all had Louis on the spine. Well, we'll take those two. And then during the pandemic, Mike found more negatives that Jack had purchased from a photographer named Maynard Frank Wolf in the 1950s. Probably, I don't know, 600-700 photos that had never been seen before. So I'll never say it's over. We're so lucky to have Mike there going through the collection, going through the negatives, and still sharing. When Mike finds something related to Louis, it comes to us. People just associate Jack Bradley with Louis Armstrong. And yes, we have the Jack Bradley collection of Louis Armstrong artifacts, but we don't have the Bobby Hackett corner and the Ruby Braff corner and the Errol Garner corner and the Duke Ellington corner and everything Jack did for jazz music for the last 50, 60 years of his life. That's still on the Cape, and it's in the capable hands of Mike, and the fact that they're digitizing it and making books and doing all these things, I think it completes a well-rounded portrait of Jack Bradley, jazz fan.
If we could now, I'd like to dip into a little bit of Louis Armstrong's career. His career virtually paralleled the length of time we've had records. There are different eras, parts of Louis Armstrong's career.
The early parts of New Orleans. So there's no recordings from New Orleans, but those are the years that really made him into a musician. They made him into a man. He learned about music and food and women and race and everything down in New Orleans. That's from 1901 to 1922. But then he comes up to Chicago, makes his first records. He has a recording with King Oliver. And then eventually he leads a series of records under his own name, Louis Armstrong, his Hot Five, his Hot Seven. Those are probably the most influential recordings in jazz history. But those are real New Orleans small group kind of things. And they caught on. And then by 1929, Armstrong comes to New York. He has a big hit with Ain't Misbehaving, which he's performing on Broadway. He's leading a big band. And between 29 and 34, he really becomes the first black pop star, where he's doing love songs. He's starting to appear in movies. And then, of course, America catches on to his innovations. The swing era is born, 1935. So Armstrong begins fronting the big band of Louis Russell. And these are the years where he's appearing in movies, he's appearing on radio, he's breaking box office records, he's recording for Decca. But by the late 40s, all of a sudden, the trends are changing. Big bands are starting to fade away. So he formed a small group, the All-Stars, which he tours with incessantly for the rest of his career. But in the studio, this is when he has his biggest pop hits, La Vie en Rose.
Magic spell you cast, this is La Vie en Rose. When you kiss me, heaven sighs, and though I close my eyes, I see La Vie en Rose.
And kiss to build a dream on.
Give me a kiss to build a dream on. My imagination will thrive upon that kiss. Sweetheart, I ask no more than this. Kiss to build a dream on. Yes. Give me a kiss before you leave me. My imagination will feed my hungry heart. Leave me one thing before we part. Kiss the bill, the dream on.
Blueberry Hill, on and on and on.
I found my thrill on Blueberry Hill. On Blueberry Hill. When I found you, the moon stood still on Blueberry.
And then by the 60s, when he's starting to slow down, he has a heart attack in 1959. It's like, how much more does he have in him? He has the biggest hit of his career with Hello Dolly, knocks the Beatles off the top of the charts. And then closes this career. He's recording in stereo. He's been there for it all. And last recordings, he's still singing, still playing. There's something coming out this summer called Lewis in London that I've co-produced for Verve Records. It's a live recording he did in 1968 with the All-Stars. And it's kind of like this perfect punctuation mark on his career. I think it's his last hurrah where he's playing and singing at the top of his powers for that era. Also has instrumentals like Back Home Again in Indiana and stuff. Really, from King Oliver 1923 to London concerts in 68, he's there for every shift, every change, and different sounds, different trends come and go. But he has hit records in every decade. He's there for all the technological breakthroughs. And today, you go on Spotify or the streaming services, he's still getting 11, 12, 13 million streams a month. For somebody born in 1901, it's unheard of.
Louis Armstrong even had a song in a James Bond movie. Is that right?
That's right. We have all the time in the world. And to tie everything in, Jack Bradley was there for that as well. The previous year, Louis had heart trouble and kidney trouble, and he ended up in intensive care. And the doctors told him to retire. They told him he would never play the trumpet again. And he spent maybe a year off the road, a year out of the recording studios. But then they were making this James Bond film on Her Majesty's Secret Service, and they had written the song We Have All the Time in the World, and they wanted Louis to sing it. And he showed up in the studio October 1969, and he sang it beautifully. But then on the flip side, he played trumpet. It was the last time he ever played trumpet in the studio, But Jack Bradley was there, and he took pictures and wrote about it in his Coda magazine column that Lewis was still hitting the high notes, and right to the end, you know, he went out swinging for sure.
We have all the time in the world, time enough for life to unfold all the precious things love has in store. We have all the love in the world. If that's all we have, you will find we need nothing more. Every step of the way will find us with the cares of the world far behind us. Yes, we have all the time in the world just for love. Nothing more, nothing less, only love.
To take another break. Back in a moment with more about Louis Armstrong and his connection to Cape Cod. This is The Point on CAI. I'm John Basile. We're talking about Louis Armstrong and his connection to Cape Cod. Our guests are Cape musician Mike Persico and Ricky Riccardi, director of research collections at the Louis Armstrong House Museum in Queens, New York. Ricky Riccardi, let's hear more of Armstrong's classic songs. This one, Jeepers Creepers, was a huge hit, of course. It also has some really great jazz singing in it. What can you tell us about this one?
Oh, that's Armstrong, his film career. So during the swing era, he starts making films. And for African-Americans in Hollywood, they did not have choice roles in the 1930s. So to some folks, Armstrong's film career is kind of dated. So, yeah, even in the movie Going Places, he sings Jeepers Creepers to a horse. But Armstrong loved those movie appearances. He knew that he was being seen by more people. He also loved doing comedy. He loved comedic roles. And the song Jeepers Creepers was actually nominated for the Academy Award for the best song of the year in 1939. And so when Armstrong records it with his big band in January of 39, it's Louis Russell's big band. It's the first recording of the great Big Sid Catlett on drums as a member of that band. You know, Louis is doing a big hit, a monster hit from a major film, an Academy Award nominated number, and it would be in his repertoire for the rest of his career.
Oh, jeebus, creepers, where'd you get those beavers? Jeebus, creepers, where'd you get those eyes? Oh gosh, all get up, had to get so lit up. Gosh, all get up, had to get that size. Oh golly gee, when you turn the heaters on, woe is me. Got to put my cheetahs on. A jeebus, creepers, where'd you get those peepers? Oh, those weepers, had to get my ties. Oh, where'd you get those eyes? Oh, jeebus, 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 creepers, where'd you get those peepers, boy? Jeebus, creepers, where'd you get those eyes? Guys, all get up, I think it's so little. Guys, all
get him, boy. Can't get that size. Golly gee, oh, when you turn those heaters on, woe is me. Got to put my cheetahs on. Jeeba, 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 scream, boy. When you get those people, boy. Oh, those weebers, how they hypnotize, yes. Where'd you get those eyes?
Ricky, do you get that sense that this was a guy who was not only a traditional trumpet player and virtually invented what we call jazz, but was also totally modern?
Oh, yeah. So the great Miles Davis quote that you can't play anything on the trumpet that Lewis hasn't played first. And then he said, even modern. It's all there. I teach a Music of Louis Armstrong course at Queens College once a year. And Queens College has a monster jazz program. And I get these musicians that come in from around the world. Many of them are getting their master's in jazz performance. After 15 weeks studying Lewis's career from King Oliver to the end, every one of them, no matter their background, they all say, yeah, that's it. You know, he is everything. Everything he was doing in 1928, we're still trying to catch up with. So there's still work to be done. But I really think as the years go by, Lewis's influence will be even more greater the more people check him out.
You'll see pretty browns in beautiful gowns. You'll see tailor-mades and hand-me-downs. You'll meet honest men.
We get to his tribute album to W.C. Handy and Beale Street Blues.
Louis Armstrong Plays W.C. Handy is the album that changed my life. When I heard that music when I was 15, I knew nothing would ever be the same. And so that, to me, is where I go to let people know that Louis Armstrong was still a force of nature in the 1950s. Because for so many years, there was this narrative that he kind of peaked with West End Blues. And the rest of his career was kind of showbiz and smiling and a couple of high notes here and there. But if you listen to him in the 1950s, and especially Louis Armstrong Plays W.C. Handy, that's some of the best trumpet playing he ever played in his career. It's some of the best trumpet playing anybody's ever played. And what I love about Beale Street Blues is he tells a story. And that's one of the great things that Armstrong put on the map. The whole concept of when you improvise a solo, you tell a story. It has to have a beginning, a middle, an end, a climax. And so Beale Street, it's at least three or four choruses at the end, and he starts so quiet and so relaxed, and by the end, he is wailing. And I've noticed my students and a lot of younger musicians, they love Armstrong in the 1950s because the sound quality is beautiful, and he is really playing at the peak of his powers.
It was almost as if the recording technology finally caught up with him.
Exactly. I mean, everybody, Jack Bradley, everybody I always talked to, they always talked about his sound. How when you heard him in public, there was just nothing else in the world that sounded like that. So finally, by the 50s, they were able to at least capture something that approached that sound.
Because the river's wet and Beale Street done gone dry.
Thank you. still early in Armstrong's career is Ain't Misbehavin'. What do we know about that one?
Armstrong said that was the one number more than any other that was responsible for him becoming kind of a crossover success. West End Blues did sell a lot of copies in 1928, but at the end of the day, it was what they called a race record. It was still a jazz record aimed at the black community, urban areas. But the record company, OK, they said, this Armstrong guy, you know, he's got something different. So in 1929, his producer, Tommy Rockwell, switched him from the race label to the pop label and had him move to New York. And he ended up on Broadway in a review called Connie's Hot Chocolates with the music of Fats Waller and Andy Razzeff. And so Armstrong's big feature every night was Ain't Misbehavin', which he would do from the pit. And it became such a big hit that they made him come out on stage and do it. So all of a sudden, he had a whole new audience on Broadway. And so he recorded it in July 1929. And as he said himself, that was the one that really made him into a pop star.
The one love through flirting, just you that I'm thinking of, misbehaving, save my love for you. Like Jack Horner in a corner, don't go nowhere. What do I care? All your kisses worth waiting for, believe me. Don't stay out late, don't care to go home about 8, me and my radio. Misbehaving, saying love for you.
The story of how Hello Dolly came to be. It seems like it was just destined to be another show tune until Louis Armstrong got hold of it.
Hello Dolly had not even opened when Louis Armstrong got to it. That's the crazy part, is that the publishers of the song, they were friends of Armstrong's manager, Joe Glazer, and they said, hey, you know, if Louis Armstrong recorded the song, maybe it would give us a good shot of publicity when we opened the play. And apparently 6 or 7 record labels turned it down, because by that point, it's the 1960s. It's rock and roll is here. Music business is a young man's game. Louis is still popular, but he's in his 60s now. But they finally found Cap Records. Cap Records said, we'll take a chance. So Armstrong goes in the studio and does 2 songs. Does Hello Dolly, tosses it off, barely even causes any impression. And then he does a song from Bye Bye Birdie called A Lot of Living to Do. Nobody was paying attention to Hello Dolly. But then the play opened up in January of 64. Cap Records strategically released Armstrong's single at the same time. The play turned out to be a smash, a lot of great publicity, great reviews. And Armstrong's single starts climbing up the charts. And this is the height of Beatlemania, where the Beatles had 14 straight weeks of number one hits. But on May 9th, 1964, 60 years ago now, Armstrong knocked off the Beatles from the top of the charts and had the number one hit in America, won the Grammy for the Song of the Year, and it became the biggest hit of his lifetime.
Was that story true that they had almost forgotten they'd recorded it until they started getting requests for it? And somebody said, what are they calling for?
That story is 100% true. Because they recorded it December 3rd of 63, and it didn't get released till late January, and it probably didn't make any impressions till February. So Armstrong's on stage one night hearing the audience yelling, "Hello, Dolly, Hello, Dolly, play Hello, Dolly." And he smiled and he ignored it and he smiled and he ignored it. And then the next night it happened again. So he finally turned to Arvel Shaw, the bassist, and he said, "What the hell is Hello, Dolly?" They apparently had to go down to a jukebox and listen to the record and listen to it over and over and copy down the chord changes and the melody and the lyrics. And the next night they did it in the show and it was pandemonium.
Hello, Dolly, this is Louis. Dolly, it's so nice to have you back where you belong. You looking swell, Dolly, I can tell, Dolly. You still growing, you still growing, you still going strong. I feel the room swaying while the band's playing one of our old favorite songs from way back when. So take a rap, fellas, find an empty lap, fellas. Dolly, never go away again.
And then there was one great coda to Louis Armstrong's career, What a Wonderful World. How did that song come about?
So What a Wonderful World is the brainchild of Bob Thiele. He was looking all over and seeing the race riots in the street and Vietnam War protests, assassinations. He said, "My God, we're coming apart at the seams. We need a message of hope. We need Louis Armstrong." And so he had a songwriter named George David Weiss write the song. And they brought in an arranger and orchestra and strings and choir. And Armstrong records it for ABC Paramount in August of 1967. But Bob Thiele never told the president of ABC Paramount, Larry Newton. Larry Newton wanted another Hello Dolly number, something peppy, a Broadway show tune, maybe add a banjo in there. And so Newton thought this thing was a waste of money. Newton and Thiele almost came to blows in the studio. And so they still decided to record it. But Larry Newton put no promotion into the song at all, and it bombed in America. It barely sold any copies. Crazily, it was discovered in London the following year, 1968, and it became a number one hit, topping Otis Redding and the Beatles and the Rolling Stones. And so it was the last great hit of Armstrong's lifetime, but it never really got discovered in America until it was used in Good Morning Vietnam, the Robin Williams film in 1988. And all of a sudden, 17 years after he died, Armstrong was back on the pop charts. Every time he sang What a Wonderful World, he thought about the block where he lived in Corona, Queens. So it's a personal song for him, and it's a personal song for us at the museum.
Ricky Riccardi of the Louis Armstrong Museum in Queens, New York. Thanks so much for being with us today.
My pleasure.
And Michael Persico of the Classic Jazz Visions Orchestra. Thank you.
Thank you.
There's more about the Louis Armstrong House Museum and Mike Persico's Classic Jazz Visions on our website, capeandislands.org. Today's program was produced by Dan Tridle and me, John Basile. Thanks for listening.
I see trees of green, red roses too. I see them bloom for me and you. And I think to myself, what a wonderful world. I see skies of blue and clouds of white, the bright blessed day, the dark sacred night. And I think to myself, what a wonderful world. The colors of the rainbow, so pretty in the sky, are also on the faces of people going by. I see friends shaking hands, saying, how do you do? They're really saying, I love you. I hear babies cry. I watch them grow. They learn much more than I ever knew. And I think to myself, what a wonderful world. Yes, I think to myself, what a wonderful world.